As food technology improves, our food becomes something very cheap that has been made to be very expensive, and we crave it. This leads us to ask, can it be that we have become the food for our food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1325th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Manila who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, if you were to watch back-to-back videos of crowded street scenes, one from just about any town or city in China, one from just about any city in the USA, you would see two different populations of people. The population on the streets of China would appear slender, while the population on the streets of the U.S. would appear plump. Seeing the populations back-to-back in this way leads us to ask, why are the Chinese so slender and the Americans so plump? Well, can it be the Chinese are starving for food? They don't look to be starving. In fact, they look downright healthy and full of life. How then do they stay so slender? Can it be the Americans are eating too much of the wrong foods? They certainly look as if they are. When we dig into this question of what Americans are eating that makes us so plump, we find a very precise technology that has made a food like a chip of fried corn taste like something else, like a south of the border taco. And as we dig deeper even into this technology and to the industry it spawned, we begin to wonder, can it be that we are becoming the food for our food? Well, let's ask Mark Schatzker, who is the author of The Dorito Effect and The End of Cravings. Mark, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me.
So I was recently hosting biology professor Andy Dyer of University of South Carolina for a conversation about feeding our microbiome. And I got to talking a little bit about how he works with his students and keeps them attentive to biology. And he said, well, I've been using a book by Mark Schatzker called The Dorito Effect. And as I dug into The Dorito Effect, I found that I was becoming attentive too. So I just kind of got to thinking about how on earth you became captivated to the extent that you have by food, by what we eat, by how we eat, so that you were held in the thrall of it to the extent that you could write two books. What was it about that food that captured you?
It's the fact that I love eating so much, and I think food is delicious, and it should nourish us, and yet so many of us have such a dysfunctional, disturbed relationship to it. It really started with my first book, which was about steak. I traveled the world looking for the best steak, but that got me answering or asking deeper questions. You know, why do we like what we like? And even interesting questions like, how do cows know what to eat? Because we think they're these kind of, you know, big fat morons and four legs munching mindlessly across the pasture, but that's not true at all. They possess a kind of nutritional intelligence. A pregnant cow eats more protein and a cow putting on fat eats more carbs. And it really opened me up to this, the relationship that flavor has to nutrition, which is something that is totally absent from the conversation in the human world. We tend to talk about nutrition from the neck down. It's all about nutrients interacting with our physiology. Meanwhile, every time we sit down to eat, we want our food to be delicious. And we almost think it's as though deliciousness is the enemy, that evolution created us to eat ourselves to death, which I don't think is true. And within all that, we find that there's a very complex but very fascinating story. And I think more than anything, we need to start paying attention to how food tastes and why it tastes the way it does and how we're really, really starting to mess that up.
And that food taste is probably what guides a cow through the pasture, correct?
Exactly. It's flavor feedback. We have a very elaborate flavor sensing mechanism. If you think of your DNA as your instruction manual, the thickest chapter is on your flavor sensing equipment, your nose and mouth. It's incredibly fast. We don't have technology that can equal its sensitivity or its speed. So clearly it's there for an important reason. And what it does is, in, you know, the challenge that we face as omnivores is that the nutrients that we need are very difficult to detect, things like vitamins and minerals. They're very stable, hard to detect. So what the brain does, what has evolved, is that we detect compounds that are easier to sense, and we associate them. So I talked about, you know, without getting too deep, I talked with a professor at Utah State named Fred Provenza, who did fascinating studies. He'd take some sheep, and he'd make them deficient in an essential mineral like phosphorus. And then he would pair that mineral with a feed. It might be flavored like coconut, or it might be flavored like maple. And what he would find is that the brain would learn, if I need phosphorus, it's this maple flavor that's giving it to me. And as he made them more deficient in phosphorus, they would go seeking more and more maple-flavored feed. Or if he paired it with coconut, it would be the coconut feed that they went after. And this tells us why we have this fast, incredibly sensitive chemical sensing system, because that is how the brain locates and uses this to find the nutrients that we need.
And you make note that the intelligence with which all of this flavor sensing mechanisms are packaged hasn't really changed forever. It evolved many, many years ago, and we still have it.
We absolutely do have it. Yes, our wiring hasn't changed. What's changed is our food environment and the degree to which we've been messing around with flavors, which is something we almost never talk about and yet take for granted.
With that, let's turn to the Dorito effect. What led you to go there? And I'll leave a real quick explanation of what it is, and then we'll go back and follow you through it.
Well, I suppose, broadly speaking, the Dorito effect describes what's happened to our food through the lens of flavor, which is to say that whole foods are getting blander. We've gotten much better at producing a lot of food, a lot of tomatoes, a lot of strawberries. But guess what? We're always disappointed when we taste them because we have an expectation they're going to be delicious, and they let us down. And this is true of so much of the whole foods that we're supposed to be eating, is they just don't pack that punch. That's why we go to Italy and eat these, you know, delicately cultivated heirloom vegetables and have a kind of epiphany and think how delicious that was. So there's kind of, here we are, you know we should be eating these wholesome foods, and yet we are making them less and less enjoyable to eat. On the other side of the equation is that we have been making junk food, processed food, more and more delicious by imbuing them with the very flavor compounds we are losing at the farm level. So junk food getting more flavorful, whole foods getting blander. But the reason I called it the Dorito effect is because of the story of the Dorito, because it really is emblematic of not just junk food, but all food. And it starts with a guy named Arch West. He was a Madison Avenue ad guy. He could have walked off the set of, what was that show? My mind's blanking. With Don Draper, Mad Men. And he was hired by the Frito company to be their VP of sales and marketing in the early 60s. They quickly merged with Lay's to become Frito-Lay. And Arch took his family on a trip to Southern California. And he was driving to San Diego when he spotted what his daughter described to me as a little shack, a little Mexican shack by the side of the road. And he's the kind of guy he had to pull over. He pulls over and he tries a tortilla chip for the first time. And he's hit with this vision that this is going to be the next big thing for Frito-Lay. So he goes back to Texas, back to Dallas, and he pitches his idea, and it just doesn't fly. They say, why do we need tortilla chips? We have Fritos. They're very similar. But he is so confident in his idea that he takes discretionary funds and develops it at an off-site facility. He repitches it. He gets them all to try these golden-colored triangular tortilla chips, and he gives them a name, which in a very bastardized Spanish means little pieces of gold. He calls them Doritos. And now he gets the green light. And I know you're thinking, okay, this is when everything changed, but this is not when everything changed, because the first Doritos were just like tortilla chips, salted. That's all they had. It said toasted corn taste, and they bombed. The complaint was, this snack tastes sounds Mexican, it doesn't taste Mexican. So Arch West has to face his colleagues, the guys he lied to, you know, when developed this thing when he wasn't supposed to, and they say, what are you going to do about Doritos? And he says, let's make them taste like taco. And this elicits laughter. And one of his colleagues says, our Yankee friend from the North doesn't know the difference between a thing and a flavor. And it was a very good observation, because back then, different things had different flavors. If you wanted to experience grape, you got to buy grapes. If you want to experience a hot dog, you got to make a hot dog. if you want to experience pizza, you got to get yourself a pizza. Well, Arch West knew that these lines were becoming blurred. Wait a minute.
Explain that.
Well, because they didn't have flavor technology back then.
Right.
The only thing that tasted like pizza was pizza. The only thing that tasted like hot dog was a hot dog. Flavor was an absolute mystery to science. We knew so much about nutrition. But flavor, these compounds that imbue food with its character, are measured in tiny amounts, parts per million, per billion, sometimes per trillion. But there was a device invented in the mid-50s called the gas chromatograph, and that changed everything. All of a sudden, scientists could capture these compounds, measure them, define them, and then we started building flavor factories. And there's flavor factories dotting every continent except Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And we produce flavors, and Arch West said, we can make a Dorito taste like a taco. Now, did it taste exactly like a taco? Of course not. But it had that tang, that zest, that depth, that umami, such that when people tasted the taco Dorito, well, their hand went right back in the bag for another one. So let's just think about that for a moment, because we talk about carbs and fat and sugar and salt, but what was it that turned a snack that nobody wanted to eat into a snack that people could not stop eating? It was a dusting of these flavor compounds. So flavor is such a big story in what's happened to food, and we need to talk about it more.
And, you know, having once worked in a potato chip factory when I was a young man, they actually fried potato chips in lard, and they had an extraordinarily delicious taste because they had that wonderful fat that you don't get anymore, of course, because they're fried in other oils. And we also, you know, sprinkled dust on our potato chips. I remember barbecue, but they never were quite the hit as a regular potato chip. So the Arch West must have discovered something very unique in his taco-flavored chips.
I think it was the blend. I think it was bringing in some of the umami tastings like Tirola yeast and MSG, but also the flavorings, such that you're starting to approximate flavor images that they don't come anywhere near the complexity of real food, but they start to put together a puzzle that's just more compelling to the human brain that pushes that button that says, eat more.
And, of course, that's all made possible by the technologies, as you mentioned, the gas spectrometer and whatnot, that we could actually look and see what's ringing the bells.
Exactly. And I mean, they have people who go into the jungles looking for new fruits to capture new flavor compounds that can push these buttons and get our brains more and more excited. And, I mean, on the one hand, it's fascinating and interesting, and you're like, I want to try these things. But the other thing to consider is that in nature, flavor and nutrition are always holding hands, that if something's going to taste like a passion fruit in nature, it is passion fruit. And that passion you experience is because there's this deep connection between how it tastes and what your body's getting. And we have just taken an axe and cleaved the two apart such that we can create thrilling sensations that are utterly dissociated from nutrition.
So you can perhaps, you know, create a tomato paste that tastes like passion fruit. And you could call it the passion fruit tomato. And people go bonkers on it and buy it and buy it and buy it.
And that's what soft drinks are. Soft drinks are just sugar water, or carbonated sugar water.
With flavorings, yes.
Yeah, so everyone says, oh, it's sugar, sugar, sugar. But is it really sugar? It's the flavorings that make us drink Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, Coke, Fanta. That's what distinguishes them, and that's what makes our brains go, oh, how about that? I want another sip.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but we are off to the races with Mark Schatzker, author of The Dorito Effect and The End of Cravings. And we're talking about, gosh, whether our food is whether we are becoming food for our food. It seems to be that way. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And we're talking right now about The Dorito Effect, which is a book written by Mark Schatzker, but it's also the nature of our food technologies now. They have learned to use flavors to make us crave our food. And in respect, it almost seems like we are becoming the food for our food, or at least that seems like we are being made to do. Does that seem sound crazy, Mark?
No, I think it's a neat way of putting it. I hadn't thought of it, but it's like the food's in control and we're the prey.
It's what it's seeming like. So what happened to Frito-Lay when Arch West introduced the taco-flavored corn chip.
It went galactic. It became incredibly successful. It's hard to imagine a more successful snack food than Doritos. They're popular all over the world. You know, just saying the name connotes a vision, connotes a mental experience, maybe even a craving. They went on to develop other flavors. Nacho cheese, Cool Ranch came in, I think, in 1983, and now there's too many flavors to count, and they rotate them, and they have, I think they even have competitions where people can vote for their favorite flavor. I think what it really taught the industry is that you can win customers by changing flavor. But even panning out, I think the big change is that flavor went from being in the control of Mother Nature to being put in the hands of the folks who work in marketing, and that was the big change.
And that's who Arch West was. He was a marketing guy, so an advertising specialist. He was working on a couple other food-related items, and Frito-Lay hired him. And it was a good hire because he certainly figured out how to sell Doritos, corn chips.
Tacos. A grand slam. It's hard to imagine a better business success in the snack food sector.
So then what? Because it didn't just stick with Doritos.
No, the reason I call it the Dorito effect, this is not just the story of junk food. You know, I mentioned soft drinks. This is the story of all food. All of our food is becoming blander, and we're adding more and more flavor to it. You can find flavoring in things like when you buy salmon at the grocery store or pork or a young chicken. There will be flavoring in there. You don't expect to see it, but I encourage you, look at the label. You'll be shocked to see all the things that have flavorings added. And it's turned food into a kind of approximation of itself. So much of what we eat does not taste like what it actually is. And this is deeply confusing to our brains. And I think we know this on some level, because we know when we eat a deeply nourishing meal, you know, if we grow our own produce or buy something at the farmer's market, it feels different. But so much of the food we eat is sort of this superficially exciting, maybe craving experience where you just sort of shove it in your mouth and you have the desire to eat more. But it's not truly satisfying. It doesn't feel nourishing. Sometimes you even feel bad after you eat, and that's not how you're supposed to feel when you eat.
Yeah, with respect to the blandness, there have been four big studies about the nutrient content of food and the diminishment of that nutrient content over the last four decades. And these studies all point to the fact that up to 40% of the essential nutrients that were in plants and crops are now gone. And yes. So with all of that nutrition gone, do you think that is what's having a big impact on the taste of food?
Yeah, so it's the dilution effect. And you're exactly correct. There has been a dilution in the micronutrients in our produce. And this is alarming because that's one of the reasons we eat these things, is for the nutrients. But it's the same story with the flavor. Now, in some cases, that's because, in many cases, the flavor compounds are actually synthesized from the essential nutrients. So I'll give you a good example. In tomatoes, there's about 26 flavor compounds in tomatoes that just make us go, wow, that is a great tomato. If those compounds are there in the right amount, we bite into the tomato and go, wonderful. Well, if you look at how a tomato makes those flavor compounds, you'll find they're all synthesized from essential nutrients, things like beta-carotene or omega-3s. Well, you can think of it that way, is the flavor is a big sign saying, hey, look at me, I'm full of good stuff, come and eat me. It worked beautifully in a natural world because the sign was telling the truth. But now we've bred tomatoes so they produce lots and lots of tomatoes, and they're disease resistant, and they've got a thick skin so they can last on the supermarket shelf. And every time you make these choices, every time you select certain traits and don't select other traits, well, you lose those other traits. So we've essentially coaxed tomatoes into being incredibly bountiful and productive, but they've lost their nuance. They've lost what makes them healthy and what makes them special. So they're becoming kind of a bloated, airheaded version of themselves, if that makes any sense.
Certainly does, because I have some in my backyard that taste a lot different than the ones I get at the supermarket.
Well, and also think about the difference there, because the ones in your backyard maybe need just a little sprinkling of sea salt and maybe a drop or two of olive oil. But you can even just eat them raw. They're fantastic. Now think about that bland, cardboard, styrofoam tomato from the supermarket. What do you do to make that go down? Well, you start adding things like ranch dressing. So much for your vegetables, right? So much for being healthy. We have to aid these in some way to make them palatable. And our whole objective of eating wholesome food has gone out the window.
And we're left with fake food, I guess. which we'll certainly be picking up with your next book, which, of course, is The End of Craving. So how did you go from the Dorito effect to The End of Craving?
Well, I wanted to understand exactly what was going on. I know that this kind of sensory monkeying about isn't good, but I want to get into exactly how this is affecting us, and I want to learn more about how the brain works with food. And what I learned is that what most of us think about food is, in fact, and the brain, how we eat, is, in fact, wrong. Most of us think that the brain, that the appetite was sort of forged in the Stone Age, and that we're just these hungry ogres, and we want to stuff ourselves full of calories just to make sure that we don't starve. Well, that actually makes no sense, because there's many reasons not to be fat in an evolutionary context. You're certainly easier to catch as prey, and you're not going to be very good at catching prey. But an even bigger reason is that if you're carrying around a lot of extra weight, it takes more calories just to lug around and maintain that weight. So it's a really inefficient way of carrying on. If calories are scarce, the last thing you want to be is really overweight, because you can't afford to lug around your big body. It turns out that the brain is actually very astute at measuring the calories it brings in and managing body weight. And we all know this, because when we go on a diet, diets fail. And it's insidious the way it works, because they actually work for about 6 months, 8 months. And that leads everyone to think, oh, the diet's working. Then around the 6 to 8 month mark, the brain goes, you know something? I don't like this weight loss business. I want you to get back up to where you were. People get tired, they get hungry, the weight comes back. They blame themselves because they said the diet was working, but this is the brain intervening and managing body weight. And it actually works the other way, because even as far back as the 1950s, scientists did studies, and they found that if they overfed people, that overfeeding, you know, they didn't just gobble food all day and say, oh, this is amazing. They found it absolutely horrific. Being overfed is almost as unpleasant as starving. So it's as though the brain wants to stick to a set point. And some of us, I'm one of these people, I've weighed the same amount for years. And it doesn't seem to matter how much I eat. If I go on vacation, I eat a lot, but then I'm, you know, not that hungry when I get back. So clearly something has changed to make this intelligent brain eat more. Well, is it that food has become delicious? That's what you might think, having read the Dorito effect, that and people talk about the bliss point, but it's actually more subtle than that. Because when neuroscientists look at a trim brain versus a brain with obesity, everybody thinks it's going to be a pleasure difference, that let's say it's a milkshake. They think the obese brain is going to take a sip of that milkshake and light up like a Christmas tree, and then it just loses control. Whereas the trim brain has a sip and says, oh, that was nice, but I'll have a little more and I'll carry on. That's not what happens. The difference is when they see what's called the cue. When the trim brain sees a picture of a milkshake, it says, hey, that looks nice. Maybe I'll have a milkshake. Maybe I'll have one later. The obese brain says, I got to have that milkshake. That milkshake looks amazing. I must have that milkshake. And then they sip that milkshake, and they have a blunted pleasure response. They're actually craving it massively and not enjoying it very much. So it's a very dismal state of affairs.
So it's kind of like being compelled to be disappointed.
Exactly, exactly. It's an existential hell, really. You crave food but are never satisfied by it. So we see that this idea of if it being an overindulgence in pleasure is wrong. So that changes the game considerably, because now we have to ask this question, well, why would a really smart brain that measures food and kind of is good at maintaining a certain body weight essentially get too excited about food and want to eat way more food than it ought to? That became sort of the driving goal of this book, was to understand why that would happen.
Now, I don't know if you've had the opportunity to look at videos of street scenes of China, but I do quite a bit. It's one of my interests. And what I see is a population of slender people. Not sickly by any means, but slender. And when I see, you know, videos of street scenes here in the U.S., we're plump as a population. So I look at that and I think, well, I'll bet the Chinese people are eating a lot closer to the ground than we are.
Well, I think certainly when it comes to intake of processed food, that's absolutely true. But I also, I'm similarly like to you, I like to look at scenes of people, but what I like to do is look back in time. Think of like your favorite band from the 70s and go look, like just Google scenes from their live concerts, and you'll be shocked. Everyone's skinny. everyone, like, they're wearing jean shorts, and they're it's just like, whoa, like, everybody is super skinny.
And this is
it,
like,
really
the 70s.
Wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, this is the 70s we're talking about, right?
Yeah. It really, you look at a beach scene, you know, look at the New Jersey beach, the California beach in the 1970s. Everybody is trim. So it's really shocking what's happened in such a short amount of time. And you're right about eating closer to the ground. You look at places like Japan and Italy. Well, here's what's so interesting. They have incredibly delicious food. People travel to these countries. Northern Italy is a culinary epicenter. They love food there. They have rules about how you're going to make food. They're not afraid of carbs, sugar, salt, or fat. They are the trimmest in the Western world. So it's not a delicious problem. There's something else that's getting us into trouble, and it's that processing. And it comes back to what I researched in the Dorito Effect, was we are monkeying around with the sensory properties of food. And it turns out those sensory properties are meaningful. When we eat, we experience sweetness, sourness, we experience flavor, and we think of these as just, you know, pleasant sensations that evolution was nice enough to give us. Isn't that nice? That meal tasted delicious. That's not why evolution does stuff. It's there for a very important reason. What this is information. When you eat, the taste of your food is giving you an early read. It's giving your brain an early read on what it's getting. This is important because you're in the jungle and you've got pressure, like, we got to move on, there's predators coming, or we don't know how long we can stay. You need to know. You don't have, you know, 40 minutes to just wait there and go, like, did I get enough calories? Do I need to eat a little bit more? Your brain's constantly measuring. But it also does this kind of post-game analysis, and it goes, did I get what I wanted? Well, if you think about the sensory properties like sweetness, for example, throughout our entire history, sweetness was really reliable. If something tasted sweet, we knew it had energy. If it tasted more sweet, we knew it had more energy. Well, all that changed a handful of decades ago with artificial sweeteners. Now we have created foods that can taste sweet and deliver no energy, maybe just a little energy. A sweet signal on a Tuesday could mean one thing, and on a Thursday, the very same signal could mean something completely different. But this isn't just sweetness. There's another family of additives called fat replacers. If you've ever wondered why you can buy something like low-fat mayonnaise or diet ice cream, it's because we've created fake fats. These are substances that have that rich, mouth-filling quality of fat that makes your brain go, hey, I'm getting some serious calories here. And what does it deliver to the stomach? Just a paltry dribble of calories. Well, this is a great idea if it turns out our brain's a moronic ogre that wants to stuff its face. Fool that idiot. You know, make him think he's getting something he's not. But if your brain's smart and your brain measures what's coming in and then it measures again what it got, this is a bad idea because the brain starts to go, hold on a second. I thought I was getting 300 calories and I got 75.
I'm hungry.
Well, yeah, and the brain says, I don't like when that happens. This is called uncertainty. And this is something psychologists have measured in many animals, and brains react in a certain way. And as a common sense thing, you might think, oh, well, you just start to ignore it if something's uncertain. But that's not what it does. It actually gets us more excited. Uncertainty revs us up. That's why we like gambling. A gamble is an invitation to uncertainty. If I say to you, do you want to bet on the baseball game tonight? You get excited by that. If I say I'll pay you $100 to shingle my shed, like, well, you might need the money, but that's not exciting. There's something about uncertainty that's exciting. It goes the brain into this excited state. Well, that's the quality we have imbued into our food with all this sensory technology, is the brain thinks it's getting something, and it gets something else. And that has the effect of making it want to eat more. There's a really good reason for this, because way back in the jungle, if something it needed became uncertain, like the tree, that tree might have fruit, it might not, it means you got to pay extra attention. It means you got to work harder to get that fruit, because if you don't get it, well, that's a loss, and if you keep losing, you're going to die. So our forebears that worked harder to achieve those uncertain things, they're the ones that survived. This is what evolution gave us. It's not that we want to stuff our faces. It's how we react to uncertainty with excess motivation. And when we look at the neurological brain scans of people, this is what we see. People who consume too much food, they want it too much. Their brains are in an overexcited state of wanting calories.
And it's pretty much caused by the uncertainty of where they're living or what they're living through.
Exactly. Their food is uncertain, and many of them face uncertain situations they live in, things like poverty, things like food insecurity, and these things can all gang up on us. But when we look at what we did to our food, It's that we started to mess around with the sensory attributes. These are not frivolous little things. This is a very important source of information that your brain uses to predict the nutrition it's getting. And that signal has gone from being certain to being very uncertain.
It seems then like our food is out to get us to be its food, to take control of us, to own us.
Yeah, well, it certainly works that way. I mean, certainly the companies that produce this, I've spoken to sensory scientists, and they were approached. It was around the early 90s that the companies were really twigging on how this worked. They were looking. They would use this word called moorish. They said, we want to design foods that cause that moorish desire.
And think about it, this is important. More.
Yeah, because the word delicious can mean more than one thing. I researched this with a very interesting woman in Germany. I can put a piece of dark chocolate in my mouth, and that is just, it takes me on a journey. You can close your eyes.
Sure.
It melts slowly, and it's you just need one. You're never really going to eat a whole box of dark chocolates. But then you get into situations like you're in an airport, and you have some crappy fast food burger. It's really not very good. But then you're like, wow, that was like 700 calories, and I ate it in about 72 seconds. Things like potato chips. Would you ever say, you know, do you ever have these memories of like, oh, I remember that bag of chips I had in the valley in Switzerland in 1999 I was hiking? We never remember it that way. These aren't culinary experiences that really strike us. But there's something that happens when you have that one chip. What does it make you do? It doesn't make you reflect on this wonderful experience you're having. You're thinking, I want another.
Moorish.
And then, like, sometimes you're like, oh, what have I done? You go and wash
it's
your hands.
It's moorish, moorish, moorish. Folks, this
exactly.
is the Food Chain. Michael Olson with Mark Kotzker. And, boy, we're Schatzker, we're talking about why we eat the way we do and what happens to us when we do. When we get back, I'd like to discuss a wonderful experiment that took place with pigs that tells us a lot about us. Do stay tuned.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Mark, of all of the things you talked about in both of your books, the Dorito Effect and this, the End of Cravings, one of the things that you talked about was an experiment that took place at the University of Illinois with respect to pigs and feeding pigs, and how that experiment aided the transition of pigs from pasture animals to confinement animals, and the impact that has had on their lives, and in respect, what it tells us about our lives and the way we eat food. So would you take us through that experiment, please?
Yeah, and if I can give you just a little bit of background as to why I got so obsessed with you know, animal science in the 1950s, it's because I was wondering why it is Italians are skinny and eat great food and we're not. And what I found is that at once upon a time, Italy was just like us. A little over 100 years ago, they were being ravaged by pellagra. Well, so is the American South. This is a deficiency of niacin. Well, what did we do? We said there's something wrong with food. It doesn't have enough niacin. So let's start putting niacin. We started putting it in flour. We started putting it in bread, other B vitamins. And it worked really well. We got rid of these nutritional deficiencies very quickly. Italy, on the other hand, they said, no, there's nothing wrong with food. People just need good food. They started to encourage poor people to grow rabbits and to even to drink wine, which actually made sense because there's niacin and the yeast in wine. Well, if you have pellagra, being given niacin is a good idea because niacin helps you metabolize the calories in your food. These people weren't starving. They were eating like corn meal and pork fat and molasses, you know, carbs, sugar, fat, but they couldn't metabolize it. You need B vitamins to metabolize calories. Well, I start to wonder, was this a good idea? I mean, this really worked well back then, but was there maybe some kind of a consequence we're not seeing? And that brought me to pig farming, because if you look at pig farming in like the 1940s, pig farmers knew if you want to get your pig big and fat quickly, feed it corn, feed it soy. And it's like rocket fuel, but you can't feed it too much because it will get a nutritional deficiency. Hair fall out, gets diarrhea, it's terrible. Well, the discovery of vitamins changed all that. Because once upon a time, if you want to balance your pig's diet, you sent it out to pasture, and it would eat alfalfa, and it would grow beautifully. It was nourished. This was a great pig. Well, now they found, hey, you can just stick it in the pen and feed it that corn, soy, rocket fuel, and you dust in those B vitamins, and guess what? You don't need to send it out to pasture, and guess what? It gains weight way faster. This revolutionized pig farming. This became optimal growth. The pigs that were on pasture, that what had been the model of pig farming, went out of style almost overnight. And this is really important because we talk about confinement farming and what's happened to farming. It was all enabled by adding B vitamins, micronutrients to animal feed. Keep them in the barn. Make them grow super fat super quickly. Well, let's look at us humans. What's our problem? We grow fat too quickly. Well, what did we do to our processed carbs? We did to our processed carbs what we did to pig feed. We started adding B vitamins. We started giving people calories, but also the micronutrients necessary to metabolize those calories. So what worked 100 years ago to get rid of a nutritional deficiency, I think now is working to make us, to contributing to the obesogenic nature of the food that we eat.
And how does the including all of those micronutrients turn us away from where we what we should be eating?
Well, because it goes right back to that pig experiment, because something really interesting happened. They would test pigs in confinement, give them the feed mix, give them, you know, let them choose. But they had one group of pigs that were still out on pasture, and they had their vitamins in one trough, and they had their carbs and their energy in the other trough, but they also had, they were sitting in pasture. And what they noticed is these pigs, they grew the slowest. They were very healthy. There was nothing wrong with them. They were the trimmest. They didn't have all that big, thick fat. But they ate hardly any of their vitamin feed. What were they doing? They were eating pasture. But then when they had pigs that were getting what's called a mixed ration, where the carbs and the vitamins were all mixed together, they didn't eat the pasture. So what this tells us is that when you're getting your vitamins, your micronutrients from real wholesome foods, it's like it turns off a switch. But when you put that stuff in the junk food, in those processed carbs, all of a sudden they lost that craving for the alfalfa. So we can look at ourselves and saying, well, it's one of the reasons we don't eat enough fruit and vegetables, because we're putting the vitamins in things like donuts and crackers and burgers and white bread. Because if we respond the way pigs do, well, the answer would seem to be yes.
And what we really want to be, what we really want to look like, are those pigs that ate on the pasture. They
exactly.
weren't fat like the pigs in the confinement facility.
That had a moderate rate of growth and that were incentivized by their environment to eat the green stuff, to eat the stuff that's good for them.
I often think it amusing that we look at confinement animal feeding operations and condemn them. And it's exactly what we are. We confined ourselves into cities, and we eat like those pigs do with respect to, you know, those refined foods. And here we are, a population of plump people. Unlike Chinese, who for some reason are not plump yet. I think it's because they're still grazing in the pasture, perhaps. So turning to the end of craving, where's that?
I think it has to do with a re-understanding of getting a better grip on how food pleasures us. I mentioned a woman in Germany I visited. Her name is Anya Hilbert, and she works with people who have really disordered eating. And what she does is she'll take people who have these incredible cravings for food, people with binge eating disorder, and they are just tormented by cravings for food. And she'll say, when you get this craving for food, I just want you to eat this one very fine chocolate. And I had one of those very fine chocolates, and like I mentioned earlier, it just took me on this journey. And what she found is eating that very fine chocolate can actually interrupt the binge. It somehow satisfies this torrential desire they have, which is telling us something important, that we've been blaming deliciousness for being the cause of this problem. It might be more like the cure. What we actually need to do is eat better food, but better real food, food that truly pleasures us and truly nourishes us and truly satisfies us.
Like the Impossible Burger?
No, not like the Impossible Burger. Maybe like a real burger, but made with you know, really good grass-fed beef and really good cheese. Maybe make a stew from really good vegetables and good meat and bake your own loaf of bread. Food like that. These are foods we know to be delicious, and we love them, and we enjoy them. And we know when we take those shortcuts, we know we're paying a price for it. We know there's something not right for it. There's a reason we call junk food, because on an intuitive level, we know there's something not right here.
Well, as somebody who thinks a lot about how people think a lot about their food, this Impossible Burger and its relations puzzles me. I can't figure out how somebody who was a vegan or a vegetarian, why they would want to eat a plant patty that has been designed to look and taste like meat. Nor can I figure out why a carnivore would want to eat a plant patty that pretends to be meat. Nothing about this thing makes any sense to me on a culinary basis.
I totally agree with you. I think what it does is it represents this conceited attitude we've had, unlike the Italians, where we thought there's something wrong with food and we can perfect food. And what really struck me is when the Impossible Burger came out and Beyond, it just got this standing ovation. Everyone's like, they've done it. They finally made meat that's better than meat. And I'm like, really? I mean, nature's been at it for a billion years, and this startup company in California run by billionaires is going to do better. This is food that is designed. Its very premise is falsification. So I think it is the absolute apotheosis of everything that's gone wrong with food. The other thing, too, they call it plant-based. Everything that makes a plant healthy, the phytonutrients, the fiber, that's all been obliterated. If you want to call it plant-based, well, Coca-Cola is plant-based, and so are Doritos. I guess there's cheese or whatever. So a bag of potato chips is plant-based. So I think they're somehow thinking just because it's made from a plant, it's healthy, but they process the hell out of it. Well, you could say that a cow is a plant processing machine, so in that case, a regular burger is also plant-based. I think it's just silly language that confuses us and is goading us into eating, once again, something we shouldn't be eating.
You know, from a culinary sense, it just doesn't make any sense, but from a political sense, it makes a lot of sense, because you can use climate change and you can use animal welfare to get rid of the cows and the cattle. Then you can get people to eat your patented plant protein that you've made to taste very good. And since you own the patents on it, nobody else can compete with you. And so that, you know, that kind of thinking, I guess, leads me back to that question. Are we becoming the food for our food? Is the industry using us as a way of eating its food? I mean,
I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about it, and I increasingly don't like the answer. So, well done.
So, how do we turn this around?
I think, you know, okay, the first thing is it's not easy. I wish it were. Everybody wants a simple thing like don't eat carbs or don't eat sugar, something like that. I think you can ask very simple questions about your food. Here's a simple one. Does what I'm eating taste like what it actually is? That sounds really weird. Go actually try it. Go and look at the labels and see how many adulterants are in so many of the foods that we eat. So that's a big one. But I'd also say eat like the Italians and the Japanese. Eat real food. Revere it. And enjoy your meals. Every meal should be an opportunity to enjoy. It's one of the greatest gifts we have is the enjoyment of food, real food. I think this is something we can fix, and food can go from being something that brings us closer to death and brings us instead closer to life.
You said revere. And when you said revere, I think of how revered the food is in Japan. The single items are packaged beautifully. Everything is presented well, and they really go for the good stuff.
Yes, and they have brands. You know, everyone's heard of Kobe beef because that is a famous brand, and brand has to do there with region. But there's also Matsuzaka beef, there's Yamagata beef, there's Iwate beef. They all kind of compete against each other, but they're all representative of regions that take enormous pride in the quality of what they do. There's you can get apples from this part of China. You can get rice, seafood from Hokkaido. They are so in touch with the quality of food and where it comes from and the traditions behind them. There's no reason we can't be like that. We instead grow foods in different parts of the country and send it all to these central processing plants that all taste the same no matter where it came from. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. That's just the way we've chosen to do it.
Because it's cheap.
Because it's cheap. But I do think there are positive signs. You know, if you look at beer was just a really highly industrialized sort of widget food. Like, it all tastes the same, like Miller Lite, Coors Light. It just tastes the same. And then we got craft beer. And what is craft beer? It's beer made with better ingredients that taste better. And craft beer, I think, is like one-third of the beer market now. Well, I think that's encouraging. I think that says that we can vote with our dollars and feed our brains well. And if we can do it with beer, we can do it with lots of other things.
So going back to that pig experiment, which pig won?
The one. It depends what you're looking for. Yeah. If you're looking for speedy growth, it's the pig in confinement, you know, kept in that confined space that ate a mixed ration. It's corn and soy was mixed with all the vitamins, and that was just the speediest pig. Depends what your objective is. If your objective is a pig that ate a nourishing diet and grew at a moderate rate, well, it was that pig out there on pasture where it had its corn and soy in one trough and the vitamins in the other, and it was surrounded by alfalfa. That's the pig I'd rather be.
I once had the opportunity to spend some time with Joel Salatin at Polyface Farm in Virginia, and he took me up into the hills up there, and where at one time it was pasture land, but the forest had come back and taken over. And what Joel had done is that he set up electric fences around these forests and was using his pigs to turn those forests back into pasture land, because they would eat everything. They root it up and turn it over and eat the roots of the plants and whatnot. And I guess, you know, when you really think about it, the ease with which you can raise a pig in confinement is really a dominating factor. Because think about raising pigs on pasture and how they can get away and how they have gotten away and become, you know, a significant problem. So it's easy to do things the wrong way. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're exactly right. It is easy to do things the wrong way. But then what I would say is go and taste one of those pastured pigs, a pork roast, a ham, a pork chop, and that'll really change your thinking, because there's a beauty in nature. It's not just producing protein. That pig is a reflection of the life it led and all the good things that it ate. And your brain knows that. That's why we have this incredible ability to taste. And when it tastes good, it's because there's good stuff in it. So it's easy to do things the wrong way, but there is something so worth it doing it the right way.
So it's when it gets right down to it, it's almost as if we can use our taste, which goes back millenniums and millenniums and evolution, the taste that we were given that hasn't changed a bit, to combat the flavorings in our food by seeking out those real tastes.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think it's just, we see this in different food environments. Like I said, in, you know, Japan or Northern Italy, you just eat incredibly well. And it's a healthier population that are trim. People are stunningly trim. Like, you go visit those places and then you come here in the airport, you're like, oh my God, like, we're just so much plumper. So I think what we need, you know, there's these two experiences, wanting food, craving it, and liking it. We live in a world where food is designed to get us in the spiral of craving. What we need to do is turn on that pleasure switch, that enjoyment, that liking switch.
And that is Mark Schatzker, author of The Dorito Effect and The End of Cravings. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real treat.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.